Mojave Salt Nutrient Management Plan has been postponed to a later meeting. Item 11, status update on the Mojave Basin Quality Trading Effort has been postponed, so we will move to item 12, report on the monitored natural attenuation evaluation and implementation in the Lahontan region. This is a draft. Ms. Kumyanjin.
Thank you, board members. Yes, this is an important report for our region, and it's a project that our staff have been working on together as a team across different programs, so including working with our state water board and the U.S. EPA. So it really is a report that crosses many lines and has a lot of good information. So I'm going to hand it over to Linda Stone to walk you through the presentation.
Thank you, Patty. Good morning, Madam Chair and board members. I'm Linda Stone, engineering geologist for the Victorville office, and I work primarily on Department of Defense site cleanups. The primary purpose of the presentation is to summarize the recommendations of the draft report on the evaluation and implementation of monitored natural attenuation in the Lahontan region. And this report came out of our monitored natural attenuation workshop at the September 2014 board meeting.
Is that arrow to the
That one?
Yeah.
As an introduction, I'll briefly summarize some of the material we covered in the workshop. Feel free to ask me questions during the presentations if I've skipped over something or we need more explanation. First of all, what is monitored natural attenuation? Monitored natural attenuation is a remedial option that relies on naturally occurring processes to achieve cleanup objectives in a reasonable time frame. And for the remainder of the presentation, I will be referring to monitored natural attenuation by its acronym, MNA, for the sake of brevity. And on this slide, we also see a diagram from EPA guidance documents that show the natural attenuation processes we rely on for an MNA remedy. And the draft report covers these processes in more detail in addition to other technical evaluations necessary for M&A. So the EPA has taken the lead on issuing guidance documents for the evaluation and use of M&A. And in 1999, the EPA issued its directive on M&A. This directive puts forth EPA policy and describes the framework for the evaluation and use of M&A. The directive is a very important document, and it's a basis for our draft M&A report also. So the US EPA directive describes the policy, states that the policy is not a walk-away approach. Rather, it is an alternative means of achieving remediation objectives that may be appropriate for specific, well-documented site circumstances where its use meets the applicable statutory and regulatory requirements. A little background on M&A in our region. Since the 1990s, when M&A first came into being used, M&A has been implemented at several DOD facilities in the Lahontan region. There is currently one M&A remedy at George Air Force Base involving three small groundwater plumes. There are four M&A remedies at Sierra Army Depot. All of them also include some in situ treatment. And there's one M&A remedy at the Marine Corps Logistics Base in Barstow. However, we do expect to see M&A proposed as the final and sole remedy at least half of our upcoming decision documents for at DOD facilities involving groundwater. So it is... is becoming more widely used. A little background on our September 2014 workshop on M&A. The board considered and provided input on the regulatory and technical requirements for M&A. The board provided input on considerations for the evaluation of the reasonableness of the cleanup time frames, which was especially helpful for staff because a lot of the proposals for M&A involve very long time frames. There was also discussion on site conditions that were of concern to the board and that would warrant additional deliberation. The board provided input on the remedial selection process. And finally, the board directed staff to develop a report on M&A that would summarize the regulatory and technical requirements and board direction from the workshop. Staff has prepared the draft M&A report based on regulatory requirements, EPA guidance, and water board input from the 2014 workshop. I should also mention here that we circulated the preliminary draft report to all Lahontan board staff, and we received a lot of valuable input, which was also incorporated into the report. So the report on M&A, So the purpose of this presentation is to So the purpose of this presentation is to summarize the recommendations from the board, solicit input from the water board on the report, and provide an opportunity for public comment. So the report recommendations are divided into three general categories. The first category relates to the minimum requirements for the demonstration of M&A's effectiveness and protectiveness. These demonstrations must be based on site-specific factors and use appropriate data and analysis methods. The first requirement is that the site has been adequately characterized for the purpose of M&A. Because M&A is a passive remedy with generally longer cleanup time frames and more uncertainties, a greater level of characterization is necessary to demonstrate that M&A will be effective and protective. Two, the source of contamination is controlled or are controlled. Source control is usually necessary to obtain cleanup goals in a reasonable time frame, and it influences the plume behavior, which is the third requirement, that the plume is stable or decreasing, and it is reasonable to expect the plume to remain stable and decreasing in the future. Fourth, that there is no threat to human health or the environment considering all pathways, and the pathways include existing and anticipated beneficial uses of the groundwater, vapor emissions, direct contact, and discharge to surface water. The fifth requirement is a demonstration that site contamination can be remediated by natural attenuation process. We need a good understanding of the processes that are occurring at a site in order to support an M&A remedy. The sixth and last requirement is that the remedial goals will be achieved in a reasonable time frame. We have a subset of factors to consider when evaluating whether or not a cleanup time frame is reasonable for a specific site. And these include performance of M&A relative to other remedial technologies, two, anticipated future need for the impacted groundwater, three, considerations regarding the site location, including the responsible party's ability to control the site and the areas around the site, and the site's proximity to a population center, or whether it is an area that may be developed in the future. A fourth consideration consists of the M&A remedy components, and that includes the strengths of the triggers and contingencies if the plume does not behave as expected, the reliability of the institutional controls, and also potentially financial insurances in place to maintain the M&A remedy throughout its lifetime. Additional considerations include the responsible party's ability and commitment to evaluate the assumptions and information used to support the selection of M&A, and resources required to oversee the remedy, including water board resources. The second major category of recommendations consists of site conditions that would require additional deliberation. One is groundwater contamination impacts a primary water supply aquifer for an adjacent community, or there is an anticipated need for the water resource. Two, the plume is near a population center, or the area is likely to be developed in the future. Three, the plume has an adverse impact on a disadvantaged community or a Native American tribe. Four, the plume impacts the sustainability of a groundwater basin or subbasin, and this requirement is based on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Five, the plume extends beyond the responsible party and or land use restrictions will impact non-responsible parties. And we skipped six, because I can't count right. And so seven, the plume unreasonably diminishes or exhausts the assimilative capacity for a constituent. Eight, the estimated time to restore groundwater quality is greater than 40 years. Nine, and the final consideration would be the uncertainties associated with the responsible party's ability or commitment to maintain the M&A components. Okay, the last category of recommendations are those regarding the selection of M&A. And they are, number one, that the M&A evaluation and selection should follow either the stepwise process of CERCLA or the process laid out by 9249, which is also similar to the CERCLA process. The CERCLA process requires a site characterization phase followed by a remedial investigation, feasibility study, and regulatory acceptance of those documents prior to a decision document. In terms of the decision document itself, it must meet all state and federal requirements and be consistent with the US EPA M&A directive. And finally, staff will update the board on the remedy selection process in executive officer reports and will request guidance from the executive officer and or the board for sites that require additional deliberation. So the next steps for the report are staff is requesting input from the board on the report. The public comment period ends on November 22nd. Staff will revise the draft M&A report in accordance with board input and consideration of staff comments. If there are substantive revisions, staff will resubmit a revised M&A report to the board for review and consideration. That concludes my presentation. Does the board have any questions or input at this time?
Are there any questions from board members?
First of all, I want to congratulate you on an extremely well-written report. I know that a lot of people and the staff were involved in preparing this report, but you who are the main fingers on the keyboard, and so job well done.
Thank you.
I'm just curious if you can explain to me how would this policy work in an area where, say, TDS was really close to one of those lines, 500, 1,000, 1,500. Would it be any different when a basin starts approaching one of those lines?
So you're talking about a cleanup site that involves that?
Yeah.
Constituent TDS.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we tried to capture on the recommendations that would require additional deliberation. And that was comment seven, or if you're counting, it was or recommendation seven or six, possibly. And the plume unreasonably diminishes or exhausts the assimilative capacity. So that's where something we would take it to Patty and the board and discuss what the best way to proceed would be.
Okay. And then the second question is, how would this work in an area where there are other... So where there are other sources of discharges to groundwater, very nearby in the same groundwater basin, how would interaction between different sources of discharges work?
You know, that would be a site-specific consideration. That's not something that I specifically mentioned, but that is something in the guidance documents do talk about. You have to think about the other plumes, the remediation going on at the other plumes. Are they pumping groundwater? Is it going to be influencing your plume? Mm-hmm. There's a whole subset of hydrogeologic factors that you need to look at, and that goes into the evaluation of, is it reasonable to expect the plume to maintain stability or continue diminishing? Okay. And those are some of the things we look at in those situations.
Okay. That sounds good. I just have a couple of thoughts, and I know that both of these concepts are in there. I'm hoping we can come up with a little language where we're a little more transparent about what it is we're asking for. So on the issue of institutional controls, I think that was on page 9 of the document that we have in front of us, that we specifically ask for the institutional controls to be enforced. It's not. I don't know if it's in your PowerPoint. It's in. You do talk about institutional controls, but specifically talk about them being enforced. Because I think there are some situations where we had institutional controls in place, but they weren't enforced, and so now we have problems with schools being built where there are on top of where there are plumes. So.
Right, and I think that. The term reliability of institutional controls, that term reliability comes from EPA guidance on institutional controls. And so one of the things about the report is I couldn't include everything in there, but what I tried to do is include references and resources and links to the guidance documents. And so there is a section on institutional controls in there.
Right.
And EPA... we would follow EPA guidance on that.
Yeah, I would just like to see the word enforced or enforcement in there. I mean, you know, people who are not in the room now are going to be the ones who are using this document, and I don't want them to send them on a wild goose chase to, look at background documents and supporting documents. I'm hoping that sort of really key ideas are right here in this document, where it's really, and apparent to any potential responsible party who is considering proposing M&A, I want them to know that, we're thinking about enforcement of these institutional controls as well as that they are put in place.
Right.
And the same thing goes with financial assurance. I mean, it's in here. It's, again, just being a little more specific, spelling out, adding a paragraph about what that means, different examples of financial assurance, that kind of thing.
Okay, thank you.
And those are my only two suggestions.
And those are tough issues.
Thank you, Dr. Horn. Any other questions or comments?
Excellent presentation, Lucas.
Thank you.
And report, of course. But what impressed me the most is on the subject of whether or not reaching remedial goals is within a reasonable time frame. I was very impressed with the 5 considerations you have outlined in looking at that, because it's such an intangible concept. How do you define what's reasonable? I think you've come about as close as we can to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Yes, Mr. Sandell.
I had a question about how you would handle, and it's hard, but institutional control is very important. What happens if you have institutional control, everything's working fine, but then due to whatever, the Air Force base is sold, it's closed and turns private, and you have a M&A site. What happens to the management of that site when the control of the property passes to somebody else?
That is a definite problem. We actually talked about that in our last water board, state board, roundtable. And what the regions shared was that what they have to do if when they're transferring a base is enroll and get some sort of agreement in place with the party that's taking on the property. So they get them into a cost recovery program, something like that, so that if the facility is, in some cases the facility stays responsible for the cleanup, but not all cases. So in that case, we'd either have the facility to go to get them to address it, or the party that took over the property would be in a cost recovery program so that we could get them to address it.
First of all, this is an excellent piece of work. Mm-hmm. And it's really obvious that a huge amount of effort went into this from a wide variety of people, and I really compliment you.
Thank you
for bringing it to us. I think I'm just echoing the comments made before, but my concern is that because the concept of M&A extends over long periods of time, that we really do have to find some mechanism that allows the requirements that are attached to that remediation to sort of run with the land and make sure that they transfer or follow the land ownership pattern no matter where it goes. And so I think it's really important to see if there's a mechanism that can be attached to title to the land in some way that would ensure that, and also that there are adequate and really clear triggers, one of which is a proposed change of land ownership that would allow this to be revisited, and if the new person doesn't want to accept the 40-year burden, that they would have to be responsible for coming up with some other option to achieve the end objectives that we're looking for. My other question was, is there any sense in which M&A can become a sort of an end process at a site where a more expensive and short-term form of remediation is initiated, and then if a certain level of cleanup is obtained, the site can then shift to the less expensive, longer-term M&A process?
Yeah, that's frequently, probably most frequently, how it's being used.
Okay.
It's sometimes used in conjunction with active remediation, as they are at Sierra Army Depot, and then following active remediation. So, and in some situations, they're proposing it as the sole remedy. But what you proposed is probably the most common application.
Thank you.
Linda, that was a good presentation. I did have one question. I'd like for us to kind of shift gears to maybe a more ethereal concept, and it's that of assimilative capacity. Mm-hmm. I just think somewhere it needs to be articulated that M&A is taking up assimilative capacity. Can you kind of articulate that a little bit for me, what your thoughts might be on that?
Well, I discussed this with Lori to some extent, and Lori, would you like to?
My name is Lori Kemper, for the record, and I'm the Assistant Executive Officer. I know, Kimberly, you brought this up at the last workshop, and Linda and I weren't sure exactly what you meant, so this is a good topic to have a conversation about. This kind of is similar to, I think, Amy's question at the beginning of the questions, that It's essentially, anytime we are leaving pollution or contamination in the groundwater, we're taking up assimilative capacity for whatever that constituent is. So when I first thought about it, I thought, well, for most of these sites, I mean, when the military comes to us and says, I want to leave benzene in the groundwater, they've already used up all the assimilative capacity, because benzene is a good example for me because the drinking water standard is one part per billion, so it's easy for me to think about in my brain, right? So if they've got a plume, you know, 2 miles long or half a mile long, and it's all, you know, 10 or 50 parts per billion benzene, well, there is no assimilative capacity for benzene. And because the drinking water standard is one part per billion, we would never authorize the discharge of benzene to groundwater. So we're dealing with a situation where there's already an unauthorized discharge of material in the groundwater, and there is no assimilative capacity. So as it relates to the particular constituent, I would say in almost every case, you've used up all the assimilative capacity, because that's why we're even looking at it, is they violated a drinking water standard. So it gets... So there's that. So we wouldn't be authorizing anybody to discharge some of these kind of man-made, you know, hazardous constituents. In the case of something like nitrate, and we do have a lot of military bases with nitrate pollution, whether it's from their own sewage or from military operations like, you know, rocket propellants or dynamite or whatever. In those situations, we need to look at the assimilative capacity in terms of other people who may want to discharge. So if you have a community that is planning a wastewater treatment plant, either a brand new plant or an expansion, and someone has already taken up the assimilative capacity, I mean, I think about it in the world of surface water and TMDL, where you can allocate the different load requirements to different dischargers, and the board has the ability to put values on all of those things. You know, you can say, well, I'd rather give Rosamond Community Service District, you know, 80% of the assimilative capacity for nitrate because they're a community that we want to see be viable and sustainable and whatever. And, I mean, you have to look at all those things from different aspects. But I think fundamentally in the situation of M&A, we're talking about discharges that occurred without your authorization. So I do think the board has a lot more authority to say, we didn't make the decision it was okay for you to put this in the groundwater. And you could reevaluate that. You could say, yeah, maybe in a certain case it's okay that we leave it there because no one else wants that space, or there's enough assimilative capacity because you've only got nitrate at 5, and the community next door can also discharge 5, or you know, the military's got it down below 10. But this gets really esoteric, because at that point, when they're below 10, we're going to walk away and say, you've done a good job. And yet they've taken up all the assimilative capacity. You know, if we walk away at 10, there's no assimilative capacity for the neighbor to discharge. So that's something that the board could consider in the future if they wanted to actually recognize that, hey, our groundwater, generally speaking, in the Lahontan region naturally is very low, and if you put a standard either lower or just acknowledge that we're going to be more conscientious about how we allow degradation to occur. And I think we're doing that systematically now. Every time you see a new permit and we go through a 6816 analysis, we're trying to say, yeah, at this location, we're going to go ahead and give that community, you know, 100% of the assimilative capacity, because this is where they want to put their wastewater. And what we're saying when we say that you can discharge up to 10 or 9.5, is nobody else is going to get that chance in this location, whether you're a fertilizer company or you're a dairy or whatever. We're giving it all to the community for their wastewater. So effectively, you're doing that today when you issue permits that allow degradation of groundwater and the discharge to groundwater. And the question of salts gets more complicated, because it's not an easy one to even do something about it. And almost every kind of discharge ends up kind of causing some salt increases over time. So, you know, so these are things we're aware of, and it's going to be challenging.
Well, Laura, you hit, I think, the example you gave of the wastewater is exactly where my thoughts were. Here we have a responsible party that has polluted the groundwater, and, mm-hmm. you know, by telling them, oh, you can have natural attenuation to treat that, we are then, you know, by de facto taking that away from mm-hmm. maybe a responsible operator that wants to expand their wastewater plant, or a community that's trying to meet, you know, its water supply needs by putting in recycled facilities, and it's like, oh, well, sorry, there's no more capacity in the basin. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly my point. I think there needs to be a dialogue anytime we look at M&A as a possible solution about what we might be giving up, you know, on a case-by-case basis. And I'd even love to see in a report a title paragraph with that dialogue, even if it says, you know, none affected, you know, no issues in the basin. Mm-hmm. I just think that needs to be a conscious part of this discussion. You know, if we've got a responsible party, they need to clean it up. Mm-hmm. If somebody else could use that assimilative capacity beneficially to serve the needs of the community. Mm-hmm. That's my whole point.
Well, I think it's a really good point, and it's really concerns me when you combine it with the long time commitment that attaches to this particular form of remediation. And I'm wondering, although I haven't the slightest idea how this gets resolved, but I'm really wondering whether or not it could be possible to approve M&A, but with the caveat that if there are changes to the demands on the assimilative capacity of the groundwater basin or the groundwater area, that that this gets reexamined. Mm-hmm. Because it's, you know, you're making a 40-year commitment not just to this party at this site, but to everybody who is potentially impacted, as Kimberly Cox has indicated. And, you know, reality tells us that we really need to plan for future discharges, although we don't know where they necessarily would come from. But there's always going to be some other problem arise, and I think you risk there's a risk involved in saying we're okay here, we've got this figured out now, and so for the next 40 years things are going to be basically the same way they are in this whole geography, and that makes no sense to me. And I think it's a way of planning for bigger problems that you just can't imagine now.
I think that's a good suggestion, and I know Linda can probably talk more about triggers, and I know there's been some discussion about it, because I know that in M&As there are triggers related to changes in geology or information. I mean, that's part of why it's called monitored natural attenuation, because the monitoring data you're collecting over time, if it shows you that, oh, the plume we thought was stable isn't stable because someone's now pulling it over, or, you know, things aren't actually decreasing, they're increasing, or, you know, if that's part of the monitored part. So, but it's focused on that groundwater quality data, but maybe that we can make sure that there's additional triggers that when they submit those annual reports, that they also do kind of a survey of land use changes, you know, or potential demands, whether it be demands on the assimilative capacity, like there's a new discharges either being planned or occurring in the area, or the need for supply, you know, that people want that water sooner because, you know, this community is growing nearby. So those, I think we could add that to make sure that it's not just focused on the data they're collecting, but some other information they've got to look at.
And is there any way that you could think of that we might be able to coordinate this kind of discussion with the people who are doing the SGMA plans?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
That's a good point. We can. I was actually thinking about that. As SGMA gets more implemented over time, you know, that is sort of a good foundation to make the changes. They do these a lot in hazardous waste cleanups under the Health and Safety Code. They're called reopeners.
Yeah, it's reopeners. And that we definitely make sure. And we do have something. We do have that in these M&As, but like I said, it had been more focused in the past on changes in the quality. So, okay.
Thank you.
Now, WQC. See, every year, Rob Eagle asks regional boards to provide suggestions for legislation down the road. I mean, this is obviously not a problem that's unique to the Lahontan region. It's going to be applicable to every region in Southern California and maybe other parts of California as well. And so this is a bigger problem, I think, that smarter heads than I have need to think about. The idea occurs to me that there might be the potential to have tradable rights to use a simulative capacity, but then they get equity issues. So there needs to be a policy statement about different uses for a simulative capacity. So I just raise that as something that we might want to elevate up the chain as an issue that might be relevant for the state board to consider proposing legislation.
Yes, and I'll just add that at DOD facilities, there's a 5-year review process. So every 5 years, we review how well the remedy is working, and we at that point you can say, well, we've got new regulations here. We need to rethink things because of this. We'll evaluate if an MCL has changed, things like that. So a new regulation could be a reopener at a 5-year review, or even sooner if not deemed necessary.
Dr. Horn, if I could also add, in February, you're going to hear more about the Mojave Basin water quality training effort, which is the first baby steps of something that you described that we're exploring right now. And I'd be happy to carry to Rob Eagle your idea. And I will mention that the state board staff are very interested in our M&A report. We've had lots of dialogue with them. So, and other regions are interested as well. So I will be sharing this, have already, with the state board in other regions.
I would just like to request, is this a draft report at this time?
Yes.
Before it is finaled, I would really like a conversation included in here on the simulative capacity, because I think it really is an ethereal concept, but I think it really merits that conversation, so we don't sell the farm today and need to grow food tomorrow, using a metaphor. I think we have to be in developing, this concept further. I think it's important that we look farther down the road, and that we include that conversation in the dialogue, and that we use M&A very judiciously and sparingly.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Very good conversation. Excellent presentation, Linda. Thank you so much. With that, we